KALW.
It could be just having a crisis going on. You know, the ends are not meeting for this month. The ends are not going to meet for the next few months.
Today, we're going behind the scenes with the operators who pick up the phone when people call seeking housing or shelter in Alameda County.
Good morning. My name is Sarah. I'm calling from Alameda County 211. Just checking on shelter space. Okay, thank you very much.
211,
how can I
help you?
Nada.
What did they say?
They don't have anything available.
It's another story from the 99% Invisible Project, According to Need. Then theater director Michael French talks about what drew his heart to the stage.
What's the event that's going to change your life? What's the event that's going to sort of help you become who you are?
That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. California's homelessness crisis has been in the headlines since the coronavirus pandemic began. Early on, Governor Newsom established an emergency housing program that's moved more than 22,000 Californians into motel rooms. Many people say the program has been a success, but still, it's a temporary solution. And just a few days ago, State Auditor Elaine Howell said California's approach to addressing homelessness is, quote, disjointed. And that might make you wonder exactly how it all works. So today we're bringing you a story that goes behind the scenes to explore that question. It's from a project of 99% Invisible called According to Need, produced by Katie Mingle. This is an excerpt from Chapter 2.
In the previous episode of this series, we spent some time with Talisha Lee, a mom who was drifting between living in her car and sometimes staying with friends or family. In that story, when Talisha finally started trying to get some help getting into housing or shelter, she began by calling 211.
Thank you so much for holding. How can I assist you today?
Yes, me and my 11-year-old son is homeless.
Okay.
I heard a lot about 211 doing this reporting, not just from Talisha, who called a bunch of times, but from everyone, from homeless people and service providers and advocates. It seemed like 211 was almost always the starting place for people who were looking for help. But mostly, when people talked about calling, they were frustrated. They'd say, I called, but it didn't work, or I called, but I didn't get anything. That's how Talisha felt. In her mind, 211 and the system were the same thing, and they hadn't come through for her. So what was 211's role in the system that helps people out of homelessness? And why did it seem like a dead end for so many people?
Hi, good morning.
Hi, I'm Katie Mingle. I'm a reporter that's here to...
Oh, that's right, Katie.
Yeah.
How are you doing, Katie?
Good. At the beginning of March, right before everything shut down for the pandemic, I paid a visit to the 211 call center. I found answers to those questions, but I also found a whole fascinating world where the boundaries that separate caller and operator are blurrier than I imagined. This is According to Need, Chapter 2. In Alameda County, 211 is run by a nonprofit called Eden INR and is located in the city of Hayward, southeast of Oakland. The main call center room is about the size of an elementary school classroom. It has brown carpet, fluorescent lighting, and nonprofit energy.
Thanks for letting me sit in on your work today. I really appreciate it.
There's a little coffee station and a mini fridge and seven operators at desks, all wearing headsets. As the day goes on, there will be moments when they are all talking at once.
You need to call them between. You need to call them between seven. It's only at 7 p.m. Monday to Friday.
Not all of the people who call 211 are homeless, but most of them are low income.
It could be just having a crisis going on. You know, the ends are not meeting for this month. The ends are not going to meet for the next few months, or someone's had an injury on the job.
That's an operator named Roshana Robinson. And she says people call 211 looking for help paying their electric bill and help paying rent. Help doing all kinds of things that money can solve, if you've got it.
Alameda County 211, how can I help you?
Just a note here, any callers you hear in this episode have given us their explicit permission to play their call. Although, in some cases, we've taken out their names.
I would like to know, do y'all know anybody that give a washing machine? I'm 93 years old.
One 93-year-old woman who called while I was there said last time she walked to the laundromat, she nearly fainted from exhaustion. She calls Roshana baby and sometimes sir, which Roshana is completely unfazed by.
A washer. Hold on one moment.
Okay, baby.
Okay. One moment.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Oh, you're welcome.
Roshana couldn't find any organizations that looked like they helped people get appliances, but she gave this woman some phone numbers to try just in case.
6-3-8-7-6.
The vast web of government services and nonprofits can be hard to navigate, especially for people who may not have the internet at home. 211 operators are trying to point callers toward resources that might benefit them, which is why they're officially called phone resource specialists. But with their blessing, I'm going to stick with the less jargony term, operator.
Can I just, like, record a little bit while you do the shelter calls?
Early in the day, Hada Gonzalez, one of the operators, starts calling shelters in Alameda County to see if they have space available.
Good morning. My name is Hada. I'm calling from Alameda County, 211. Just checking on shelter space. Okay, thank you very much. Bye-bye. They don't have anything available.
Hada's been an operator at 211 for 7 years, and she's done these calls so many times that the words come out quick and tonal, almost divorced from meaning.
Good morning. My name is Hada. I'm calling from Alameda County, 211. Just checking on shelter space. Okay, thank you. Nothing.
A lot of people who call 211 are looking for shelter, and if there are spaces available, the operators can help reserve them a bed. But keeping track of an inventory of shelter beds is more challenging than you might imagine. The number of open beds is always in flux. There are shelters that have 80 beds in the winter and 60 in the summer, and beds that just suddenly pop up in some random church basement. There are separate shelters reserved for victims of domestic violence. There are shelters that take moms with their kids if the kids are under 10, but not over 10. There are currently no shelters in the county that accept fathers with their kids, but there might be one opening soon. Hada calls a few more shelters with the same results. Nothing. No space available. So far today, all they have to offer callers is one spot for a mother and two children.
It's hard. It's frustrating.
Roshana told me she got a call recently from a mother who needed shelter for that night, and she had nothing to give her.
And just on the phone with me, I can hear her frustration. She's like, so, huh? What do I got to do? It's nothing. It's nowhere. She's like, so me and my child literally about to be on the streets tonight. I wanted to go buy her a hotel room. I was on the phone with her for 33 minutes. And she was, I know she was staying on the phone with me to think I was going to give her, like, her light of hope. And I was hopeless to her.
Already I was starting to understand why people were always saying, I called 211 and I didn't get anything. They weren't getting anything because there was nothing to give.
Thank you for calling Alameda County 211. How can I help you?
Homeless callers who want help with something other than shelter, like housing, for example, will have to get into the county's coordinated entry system. And this was the same system Talisha had entered. 211, it turns out, is sort of like a doorman for this system, opening the door for some people to enter, but not for others.
3120. Okay, and you're looking for housing?
Okay. Around 10 a.m., I get to see one of these calls. An operator named Gurpreet Minhas gets a call from a 24-year-old mother who wants help with housing.
First and last name?
To get that help, she'll need to go into the coordinated entry system. But whether she makes it in at all depends essentially on how she answers one question.
And where did you guys sleep or stay last night?
Gurpreet is screening this caller to determine if she meets the definition of literal homelessness, according to the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and by extension, Alameda County. That's the actual term they use, literal homelessness. You are literally homeless if last night you slept in a shelter or in a place not meant for human habitation, like a tent or a car or a broken down RV. If this is the case, then you get the rubber stamp of literal homelessness, and the operators can pass you along to do a longer interview, in which you'll be asked a bunch more questions about your particular situation and then entered into the system. But here's the kind of maddening thing. Say you stay in the car for 3 months, and then one day you sleep at a friend's house, but that's the day you happen to call 211. In that case, you're not literally homeless, according to their definition. And if you're not literally homeless, you can't get into the system at all, which means you can't get help with housing. And this caller that Gurpreet is talking to, she seems to realize this. We don't have permission from her to play the recording, so I'll paraphrase what's happening on her end. In response to Gurpreet's question about where she slept last night, the caller says, "Someone told me that I should tell you I've been sleeping in my car."
It's not what somebody told you, it's just where did you sleep last night?
To this, the caller says, "Well, my kids don't sleep in the car, but I do."
So last night, where did you sleep? Did you sleep in the car? Did you sleep on the street? Did you sleep in someone's home? Where did you sleep?
"I'm couch surfing," she says. "But when there's no room, I go to my car."
Okay, so question again. Where were you last night? Where did you sleep last night?
"In my car, in my car."
Okay. How long have you been sleeping in your car?
Now the caller sighs. Finally, she says, "I feel like you guys want a straightforward answer, but I can't give you one."
It's pretty simple questions, ma'am, and...
This caller's situation is complicated and in flux, but Gurpreet needs to check a box.
Give me 1 second. I'm going to put you on hold, and I'll see if I can get them on the other line, okay?
Gurpreet does forward her on, even though it feels unclear to her whether the woman fulfills the criteria or not. The longer interview might reveal that she doesn't meet the definition of literal homelessness after all.
She wants to say she's literally homeless, but I think she's actually been staying at a friend's house where she's going to end up saying that. And then what they're trying to help with this program is individuals who don't have any other resources.
I mean, it seems like part of what she was getting hung up on is that the questions sort of didn't account for, like, nuance.
Mm-hmm. And I understand we need to be more, you know, more patient, but sometimes it's just so difficult because they're just like constantly like attacking you and you're just asking them simple questions, but it's just so, it's like a struggle.
When Talisha Lee called 211 in the last episode, she could truthfully say she was sleeping in her car at the time, which meant she was ultimately allowed to enter the system. But hers was a similarly in-flux situation. She was often drifting between sleeping in the car and sleeping on someone's floor or couch. Staying with other people like that in a temporary, unstable way is often referred to as being doubled up. The Department of Education reported that there were about 220,000 students in California who were living doubled up in 2018. That's 220,000 kids plus their parents or guardians that HUD may not be counting as homeless, who do not, in fact, have homes. And when those people call 211, they're told they're not literally homeless.
People really get frustrated when you tell them they're not literally homeless, and they're like, "I am homeless. What do you mean? I'm sleeping on the effing couch, and I'm sleeping in my effing car, and I just got let in last night."
But even when people do make it into the coordinated entry system, they don't always get help. I mean, Talisha had gotten into the system, and she hadn't gotten anything. Rashana seemed unclear on what exactly happens to people after they get in.
So I tell them it's case by case.
And so, like, they basically end up on a list. Is that your understanding?
Basically, yeah.
Rashana doesn't get to find out what happens to people after they get on the list. But what she does know is that they don't always get housing, and that's because those same people end up calling 211 again.
That was an excerpt from Chapter 2 of According to Need. It's a project of 99% Invisible, produced by Katie Mingle. You can hear the rest of that story at 99percentinvisible.org/need. According to Need was produced by Katie Mingle with associate producer Abby Madon and managing editor Whitney Henry Lester. Sound engineering by Kevin Ramsey. Music by Sean Rial. You're listening to Cross Currents from KELW News. I'm Hannah Baba. The pandemic continues to push artists to find creative ways to showcase their work safely. With playhouses closed, Word for Word Performing Arts Company moved its shows from the theater straight to the ears of their audiences. They now perform short fiction stories in the form of audio dramas. Oakland's Michael French is director of Word for Word's latest production, Books and Roses, by British author Helen Oyeyemi. The story is about a girl who was left on the steps of a Barcelona monastery as a baby and the search for her mother. Michael French spoke with KELW's Janae Darden about his theater career from London to the Bay.
How did your passion for theater begin?
My passion for theater, you know, I think, in all honesty, my father and I had a difficult relationship. And the one place where we could really sort of meet in the middle was when there was a program on television called Play for Today. And it was really theater on television. He loved theater. And that's the one time where I would either sit next to him, sit on his knee, and we would both watch this program. And for whatever reason, there was something in this show where it spoke to me. And it was in there for some time without me recognizing what it was or even recognizing how much it meant to me. I went to a grammar school called Archbishop Tennyson's Grammar School. And on the way back from that school, there was a community arts center. And I'd walk past it every day. And then for whatever reason, that one day came where instead of walking past it to go home, I turned and went through the doors and just walked around and nobody stopped me. There's this little kid, I may have been 13. And I just walked around and they were getting ready to set up a play in the main theater. So I saw the lights arrive. I saw the set arrive. I saw the costumes arrive. And so I really got to see how this empty room was transformed into this place from another time. And I think that was the moment when my days sitting next to my father, sort of both of them came together. And I suddenly thought, I don't know what this is, but I want to know. So I just kept going back there. And in the end, they said, hey, what are you doing here? Do you want to help? Go and get that light. Bring that light over here. And then I just suddenly found myself there sort of every evening helping to sort of set things up. I eventually went to work there. So
that almost sounds magical.
It's one of those things where you do something as simple as, again, you don't really, no one ever knows that what's the event that's going to change your life. What's the event that's going to sort of help you become who you are? And it usually starts from something really ordinary. It's not the burning bush. You know, it's usually just walking into this room and there's people walking around and it turned into the career that I've done for all of my adult life.
So a lot of times when people go into theater, they want to be actors.
That's how it started, to be honest with you. But it started as an actor, but deep down, you know, to say you want to be a theater director at 14, forget it. I don't know people who've got that kind of confidence to use that phrase. I didn't have that confidence. And there wasn't any theater directors that looked like me. And so it was really hard for me to say to myself that I'm a theater director. I didn't even know the phrase. And so I went into acting not feeling that comfortable, really. I kind of knew it wasn't me, but I didn't know. I knew it was in this area somehow. And I remember I had a roommate called David O'Kelly. And he was a real actor. He was working actor on the fringe circuit in London, doing small parts on television. And he came home one day and he said, God, this director in this play, she's terrible. He said, I'm not sure how this is not going to turn out well. And before I could shut my mouth, I said, I'll direct her. And I hadn't done any directing classes. And it just came out of me. Mm-hmm. And he said, okay. And then 2 days later, I was in a rehearsal room. And all I can say to you is the minute I stepped into that rehearsal room, I knew how it worked. I just knew it.
What brought you to the Bay?
To be honest with you, really what drove me out here was this idea of San Francisco in the 1970s, in all honesty. That's what I thought I was going to find. And I had San Francisco in my mind. And then I got here, lived in Oakland, and I thought, oh, wow, this isn't the Oakland I thought it was going to be. You know, because there are some towns that you get to hear about for good or ill way before you step foot in them. And Oakland mm-hmm. was one of them.
What did you hear about Oakland? And you know, I have to ask that. I was like, oh, the laugh says it all. So what were you told about Oakland and what were your thoughts of Oakland after getting here?
It was a place to sort of be wary of, to be honest with you. At least that was the impression I got. The image I got was mostly during the sort of crack epidemic. Mm-hmm. And so I didn't expect to find what I found. I didn't expect to find the sort of variety of Oaklanders, the variety of neighborhoods. It was just given this blanket image at one point. I'm so glad that something in me, even if it was for different reasons, came here to find out what's really going on.
Let's talk about Books and Roses.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Yes, this audio drama from Word for Word Theater Company.
Yeah.
So tell us, what is this story about?
The story is about a little baby called Montserrat, who's left outside this Benedictine chapel by her mother, who had decided, I can't raise you, but I know these people can take care of you in the way that I want you to. So she leaves the baby at the chapel, and the monks raise her, in effect, for the first sort of early part of her life. And around her neck is a key on a chain. And so the story becomes about Monty, as she's known in the story, trying to find the lock to that key. And it's written by Helen Oyeyemeh. It's a short story, and I adapted it into a script, but without changing any of the other words. And the way that Helen writes, it's part magic realism, it's part folklore, it's part myth, and it's got a lot of social realism in there. And she writes with a kindness for words. All writers have a love of words, but some writers have a kindness for them and a kindness for her characters that just immediately grabbed me.
And you've directed so many productions over the years.
Yeah.
What do you think makes a good director?
If the director's in the room, to do anything other than work with actors, it's the wrong director. There are a lot of directors that are stylists, creating a mood. But what you're really in the room to do is to tell the emotional story of the plot. And so the playwright's going to give you the, this is what happens next, and this is what happens next, and this is what happens next. But what we have to do, the actors and directors, find out why. And so what you're really giving to the audience is, this is why this is happening. And that why allows the audience, hopefully, to find empathy with the characters and maybe empathy with some of the decisions they've made in their own life.
That was theater director Michael French speaking with KELW's Janae Darden. Part 3 of Books and Roses will be released this Sunday. Find more information at KELW.org and check out more audio dramas on KELW's Open Air, Thursdays at 1 p.m. Today's Cross Currents team includes Annalise Finney, Andrew J.M. Garcia, Sonia Narang, and Marissa Ortega Welch. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Production manager is Shireen Adil. Managing editor is David Boyer. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.